Side 3, Gateway, continuing on page 110. Plant maintenance was actually the maintenance of plants, specifically the ivy plants that helped keep Gateway livable. I reported for duty, and surprise, in fact, nice surprise, my crew boss turned out to be my legless neighbor, Chiquitee Bakin. He greeted me with what seemed like real pleasure. "How nice of you to join us, Robinette," he said. "I expected you would ship out at once." "I will, Chiqui, pretty soon. When I see the right launch listed on the board, I'll know it." Of course. He left it at that and introduced me to the other plant maintainers. I didn't get them straight, except that the girl had had some sort of connection with Professor Hegrame, the hotshot hecheologist back home, and the two men had each had a couple of missions already. I didn't really need to get them straight. We all understood the essential fact about each other without discussion. None of us was quite ready to put our names on the launch roster. I wasn't even quite ready to let myself think out why. Plant maintenance would have been a good place for thought, though. Chiqui put me to work right away, fastening brackets to the heechy metal walls with tacky gunk. That was some kind of specially designed adhesive. It would hold to both the heechy metal and the ribbed foil of plant boxes, and it did not contain any solvent that would evaporate and contaminate the air. It was supposed to be very expensive. If you got it on you, you just learned to live with it, at least until the skin it was on died and flaked off. If you tried to get it off any other way, you drew blood. When the day's quota of brackets were up, we all trooped down to the sewage plant, where we picked up boxes filled with sludge and covered with cellulose film. We settled them onto the brackets, twisted the self-locking nuts to hold them in place, and fitted them with watering tanks. The boxes probably would have weighed 100 kilos each on Earth, but on Gateway, that simply wasn't a consideration. Even the foil they were made of was enough to support them rigidly against the brackets. Then, when we were all done, Chiqui himself filled the trays with seedlings while we went on to the next batch of brackets. It was funny to watch him. He carried trays of the infant ivy plants on straps around his neck, like a cigarette girl stock. He held himself at tray level with one hand and poked seedlings through the film into the sludge with the other. It was a low-pressure job. It served a useful function, I guess, and it passed the time. Chiqui didn't make us work any too hard. He had set a quota in his mind for a day's work. As long as we got 60 brackets installed and filled, he didn't care if we goofed off, provided we were inconspicuous about it. Clara would come by to pass the time of day now and then, sometimes with a little girl, and we had plenty of other visitors. And when times were slack and there wasn't anybody interesting to talk to, one at a time, we could wander off for an hour or so. I explored a lot of Gateway I hadn't seen before, and each day decision was postponed. We all talked about going out. Almost every day we could hear the thud and vibration as some lander cut itself loose from its dock, pushing the whole ship out to where the Heechee main drive could go into operation. Almost as often, we felt the different kind of smaller, quicker shock when some ship returned. In the evenings, we went to someone's parties. My whole class was gone by now, almost. Sherry had shipped out on a 5. I didn't see her to ask her why she changed her plans, and wasn't sure I really wanted to know. The ship she went on had an otherwise all-male crew. They were German-speaking, but I guess Sherry figured she could get by pretty well without talking much. The last one was Willa Forehand. Clara and I went to Willa's farewell party, and then down to the docks to watch her launch the next morning. I was supposed to be working, but I didn't think Chiqui would mind. Unfortunately, Mr. Sheehan was there, too, and I could see that he recognized me. "Oh, shit," I said to Clara. She giggled and took my hand, and we ducked out of the launch area. We strolled away until we came to an upshaft and lifted to the next level. We sat down on the edge of Lake Superior. "Bob, old stud," she said, "I doubt he'll fire you for screwing off one time. Chew you out, probably." I shrugged and tossed a chip of filter pebble into the upcurving lake, which stretched a good 200 meters up and around the shell of Gateway in front of us. I was feeling tacky and wondering whether I was reaching the point when the bad vibes about risking nasty death in space were being overtaken by the bad vibes about cowering on Gateway. It's a funny thing about fear. I didn't feel it. I knew that the only reason I was staying on was that I was afraid, but it didn't feel as though I were afraid, only reasonably prudent. "I think," I said, watching myself going into the sentence without being sure how it was going to come out, "that I'm going to do it. Want to come along?" Clara sat up and shook herself. She took a moment before she said, "Maybe. What have you got in mind?" I had nothing in mind. I was only a spectator, watching myself talk myself into something that made my toes curl. But I said, as though I had planned it out for days, "I think it might be a good idea to take a rerun." "No deal," she looked almost angry. "If I go, I go where the real money is." That was also where the real danger was, of course, although even reruns have turned out bad often enough. The thing about reruns is that you start out with the knowledge that somebody has already flown that trip and made it back, and not only that, made a find that's worth following up on. Some of them are pretty rich. There's Peggy's World, where the heater coils and the fur come from. There's Eta Carina 7, which is probably full of good stuff if you could only get at it. The trouble is, it has had an ice age since the Heechees were last on it. The storms are terrible. Out of 5 landers, 1 returned with a full crew, undamaged. 1 didn't return at all. Generally speaking, Gateway doesn't particularly want you to do a rerun. They will make a cash offer instead of a percentage, where the pickings are fairly easy, as on Peggy. What they pay for is not so much trade goods as maps. So you go out there, and you spend your time making orbital runs, trying to find the geological anomalies that indicate Heechee digs may be present. You may not land at all. The pay is worth having, but not lavish. You'd have to make at least 20 runs to build up a lifetime stake if you take the corporation's one-pay deal. And if you decide to go on your own prospecting, you have to pay a share of your profits to the Discovery crew and a cut on what's left of your share to the corporation. You wind up with a fraction of what you might get on a virgin find, even if you don't have a colony already established on the scene to contend with. Or you can take a shot at the bonuses. $100 million if you find an alien civilization, $50 million for the first crew to locate a Heechee ship bigger than a 5, $1 million to locate a habitable planet. Seems funny that they would only pay a lousy million for a whole new planet, but the trouble is, once you've found it, what do you do with it? You can't export a lot of surplus population when you can only move them 4 at a time. That, plus the pilot, is all you can get into the largest ship in Gateway. And if you don't have a pilot, you don't get the ship back. So the corporation has underwritten a few little colonies. One's very healthy on Peggy, and the others are spindly. But that does not solve the problem of 25 billion human beings, most of them underfed. You'll never get that kind of bonus on a rerun. Maybe you can't get some of those bonuses at all. Maybe the things they're for don't exist. It is strange that no one has ever found a trace of another intelligent creature. But in 18 years, upwards of 2,000 flights, no one has. There are about a dozen habitable planets, plus another 100 or so that people could live on if they absolutely had to, as we have to on Mars and on, or rather, in Venus. There are a few traces of past civilizations, neither Heechee nor human. And there are these souvenirs of the Heechee themselves. At that, there's more in the Warrens of Venus than we've found almost anywhere else in the galaxy so far. Even Gateway was swept almost clean before they abandoned it. Damn Heechee. Why did they have to be so neat? Letter from Chicotee Bakin to Eret Suni, his honored grandson. I'm overwhelmed with joy to learn of the birth of your first child. Do not despair. The next will probably be a boy. I apologize humbly for my failure to write sooner, but there is little to tell. I do my work and attempt to create beauty where I can. Perhaps someday I will go out again. It is not easy without legs. To be sure, Eret Suni, I could buy new legs. There was a close tissue match just a few months ago. But the cost, I might almost as well buy full medical. You are a loyal grandson to urge me to use my capital for this, but I must decide. I'm sending you a half of my capital now to assist with my great-granddaughter's expenses. If I die here, you will receive all of it, for you and for the others who will be born to you and your good wife before long. This is what I want. Do not resist me. My deepest love to all three of you. If you can, send me a holo of the cherry blossoms. They are in bloom soon, are they not? One loses sense of home time here. Lovingly, your grandfather. End letter. So we gave up on the rerun deals because there wasn't enough money in them, and put the special finder's bonuses out of our heads because there's just no way of planning to look for them. And finally, we just stopped talking and looked at each other, and then we didn't even look at each other. No matter what we said, we weren't going. We didn't have the nerve. Clara's had run out on her last trip, and I guess I hadn't ever had it. Well, said Clara, getting up and stretching, I guess I'll go up and win a few bucks at the casino. Want to watch? I shook my head. Guess I'd better get back to my job, if I still have one. So we kissed goodbye at the upshaft, and when we came to my level, I reached up and patted her ankle and jumped off. I was not in a very good mood. We had spent so much effort trying to reassure ourselves that there weren't any launches that offered a promise of reward worth the risks that I almost believed it. Of course, we hadn't even mentioned the other kind of rewards, the danger bonuses. You have to be pretty afraid to go for them. Like a corporation will sometimes put up $500,000 or so incentive bonus for a crew to take the same course as some previous crew tried and didn't come back from. The reasoning is that maybe something went wrong with the ship, run out of gas or something, and a second ship might even rescue the crew from the first one. Fat chance. More likely, of course, whatever killed the first crew would still be there and ready to kill you. Then there was a time when you could sign up for $1 million. Later they raised it to $5 million if you would try changing the course settings after launch. The reason they raised the bonus to $5 million was that crews stopped volunteering when not one of them ever came back. Then they cut it out because they were losing too many ships, and finally they made it a flat no-no. Every once in a while, they come up with a bastard control panel, a snappy new computer that's supposed to work symbiotically with the Hiji board. Those ships aren't good gambling bets either. There's a reason for the safety lock on the Hiji board. You can't change destination while it's on. Maybe you can't change destination at all without destroying the ship. I saw five people try for a $10 million danger bonus once. Some corporation genius from the permanent party was worrying about how to transport more than five people, or the equivalent in cargo, at once. We didn't know how to build a Hiji ship, and we'd never found a really big one, so we figured that maybe we could end run around that obstacle by using a five as a sort of tractor. So they built a sort of space barge out of Hiji metal. They loaded it with scraps of junk and ran a five out there on lander power. That's just hydrogen and oxygen, and it's easy enough to pump that back in. Then they tied the five to the barge with monofilament Hiji metal cables. We watched the whole thing from gateway on PV. We saw the cables take up slack as the five put a strain on them with its lander jets. Craziest looking thing you ever saw. Then they must have activated the long-range start teat. All we saw on the PV was that the barge sort of twitched and the five simply disappeared from sight. It never came back. The stop-motion tapes showed at least the first little bit of what happened. The cable truss had sliced that ship into segments like a hard-boiled egg. The people in it never knew what hit them. The corporation still has that $10 million. Nobody wants to try for it anymore. Mission report. Vessel 5-2. Voyage 08-D33. Crew L. Konichny, E. Konichny, F. Ito, F. Lounsbury, A. Akaga. Transit time out 27 days, 16 hours. Primary not identified, but probability high as star in cluster 47 to Caney. Summary. Emerged in free fall. No planet nearby. Primary A6, very bright and hot. Distance approximately 3.3 AU. By masking the primary star, we obtained a glorious view of what seemed to be 200 or 300 nearby very bright stars, apparent magnitude ranging from 2 to minus 7. However, no artifacts, signals, planets, or landable asteroids were detected. We could remain on station only 3 hours because of intense radiation from the A6 star. Larry and Evelyn Konichny were seriously ill on the return trip, apparently due to radiation exposure, but recovered. No artifacts or samples secured. End mission report. I got a politely reproachful lecture from Shiki and a really ugly but brief P phone call from Mr. Sheehan, but that was all. After a day or two, Shiki began letting us take time off again. I spent most of it with Clara. A lot of times we'd arrange to meet in her pad, or once in a while mine, for an hour in bed. We were sleeping together almost every night. You'd think we would have had enough of that. We didn't. After a while, I wasn't sure what we were copulating for, the fun of it, or the distraction it gave from the contemplation of our own self-images. I would lie there and look at Clara, who always turned over and snuggled down on her stomach and closed her eyes after sex, even when we were going to get up 2 minutes later. I would think how well I knew every fold and surface of her body. I would smell that sweet, sexy smell of her and wish, oh, wish, just wish for things I couldn't spell out. For an apartment under the big bubble with Clara, for an air body and a cell in a Venusian tunnel with Clara, even for a life in the food mines with Clara. I guess it was love, but then I'd still be looking at her, and I would feel the inside of my eyes change the picture I was seeing, and what I would see would be the female equivalent of myself, a coward given the greatest chance a human could have, and scared to take advantage of it. When we weren't in bed, we would wander around Gateway together. It wasn't like dating. We didn't go much to the Blue Hell or the Holofilm Halls or even eat out. Clara did. I couldn't afford it, so I took most of my meals from the corporation's refectories, included in the price of my per capita per diem. Clara was not unwilling to pick up the check for both of us, but she wasn't exactly anxious to do it either. She was gambling pretty heavily and not winning much. There were groups to be involved with, card parties or just parties, folk dance groups, music listening groups, discussion groups. They were free and sometimes interesting. Or we just explored. Several times we went to the museum. I didn't really like it that much. It seemed, well, reproachful. The first time we went there was right after I got off work the day Willa Forehand shipped out. Usually the museum was full of visitors like crew members on pass from the cruisers or ship's crews from the commercial runs or tourists. This time, for some reason, there were only a couple of people there, and we had a chance to look at everything. Prayer fans by the hundreds, those filmy little crystalline things that were the commonest Hechi artifact. No one knew what they were for, except that they were sort of pretty. But the Hechi had left them all over the place. There was the original anisokinetic punch that had earned a lucky prospector something like $20 million in royalties already, a thing you could put in your pocket. Furs, plants, and formalin, the original paisophone that had earned 3 crews enough to make every one of them awfully rich. The most easily swiped things like the prayer fans and the blood diamonds and the fire pearls were kept behind tough, brick-proof glass. I think they were even wired to burglar alarms. That was surprising on Gateway. There isn't any law there except what the corporation imposes. There are the corporation's equivalent of police, and there are rules. You're not supposed to steal or commit murder, but there aren't any courts. If you break a rule, all that happens is that the corporation's security force picks you up and takes you out to one of the orbiting cruisers. Your own, if there is one from wherever you came. Anyone, if not. But if they won't take you, or if you don't want to go on your own nation's ship, and can persuade some other ship to take you, Gateway doesn't care. On the cruisers, you'll get a trial. Since you're known to be guilty to start with, you have 3 choices. One is to pay your way back home. The second is to sign on as crew, if they'll have you. The third is to go out the lock without a suit. So you see that although there isn't much law on Gateway, there isn't much crime either. But of course the reason for locking up the precious stuff in the museum was that transients might be tempted to lift a souvenir or two. So Clara and I would muse over the treasures someone had found and somehow not discuss with each other the fact that we were supposed to go out and find some more. It was not just the exhibits. They were fascinating. They were things that Hechi hands, tentacles, claws, had made and touched, and they came from unimaginable places, incredibly far away. But the constantly flickering tube displays held me even more strongly. Summaries of every mission ever launched, displayed one after another. A constant total of missions versus returns, of royalties paid to lucky prospectors. The roster of the unlucky ones, name after name in a slow crawl along one whole wall of the room over the display cases. The totals told the story. 2,355 launches. The number changed to 2,356, then 2,357 while we were there. We felt the shudder of the two launches. 841 successful returns. Standing in front of that particular display, Clara and I didn't look at each other, but I felt her hand squeeze mine. That was defining successful very loosely. It meant that the ship had come back. It didn't say anything about how many of the crew were alive and well. We left the museum after that and didn't speak much on the way to the upshaft. The thing in my mind was that what Emma Father had said to me was true. The human race needed what we prospectors could give them, needed a lot. They were hungry people, and Heechee technology probably could make all their lives a lot more tolerable if prospectors went out and brought samples of it back, even if it cost a few lives. Even if the lives included Clara's and mine. I asked myself, want my son, if I ever had a son, to spend his childhood the way I had spent mine. We dropped off the up cable at Level Babe and heard voices. I didn't pay attention to them. I was coming to a resolution in my mind. Clara, I said, listen, let's... But Clara was looking past my shoulder. For Christ's sake, she said, look who's here. And I turned, and there was Shiki, fluttering in the air, talking to a girl. And I saw with astonishment that the girl was Willa Forehand. She greeted us, looking both embarrassed and amused. What's going on? I demanded. Didn't you just ship out, like maybe 8 hours ago? 10, she said. Did something go wrong with the ship, so you had to come back? Clara guessed. Willa smiled ruefully. Not a thing. I've been there and back. Shortest trip on record so far. I went to the moon. Earth's moon? That's the one. She seemed to be controlling herself to keep from laughter or tears. Shiki said consolingly, they'll surely give you a bonus, Willa. There was one that went to Ganymede once, and the corporation divvied up $500,000 among them. She shook her head. Even I know better than that, Shiki dear. Oh, they'll award us something, but it won't be enough to make a difference. We need more than that. That was the unusual and somewhat surprising thing about the Forehands. It was always we. They were clearly a very closely knit family, even if they didn't like to discuss that fact with outsiders. I touched her, a pat between affection and compassion. What are you going to do? She looked at me with surprise. Why, I've already signed up for another launch day after tomorrow. Well, said Clara, we've got to have two parties at once for you. We'd better get busy. And hours later, just before we went to sleep that night, she said to me, wasn't there something you wanted to say to me before we saw Willa? I forget, I said sleepily. I hadn't forgotten. I knew what it was, but I didn't want to say it anymore. Classifieds. Maid, cook, or companion. Head tax plus $10 a day. Phyllis, 88-423. Gourmet foods, hard to get, Earth imports. Take advantage my grouped mass guarantee unique co-op order service for any item you want. Save expensive single-item shipping costs. Sears, Bradley, GUM, catalogs available. 87-747. Fresh fish from Australia. Male, good-looking, seeks intimate French female. Companionship. 65-182. Organs for sale or trade. Any paired organs. Best offer. Need posterior coronal heart sections. Left auricle, left and right ventricle, and associated parts. Phone 88-703 for tissue match. Hanefatafl players. Swedes or Muscovites. Grand Gateway Tournament. Will teach. 88-122. pen pal from Toronto would like to hear you tell what it's like out there. Address, Tony, 955 Bay, Toronto, Canada, M5S2A3. I need to cry. I will help you find your own pain. Phone 88-622. End classifieds. There were days when I worked myself up almost to that point of asking Claire to ship out with me again. And there were days when a ship came in with a couple of starved, dehydrated survivors, or with no survivors. Or when at the routine time, a batch of last year's launches were posted as non-returns. On those days, I worked myself up almost to the point of quitting Gateway completely. Most days, we simply spent deferring decision. It wasn't all that hard. It was a pretty pleasant way to live, exploring Gateway and each other. Clara took on a maid, a stocky, fair young woman from the food mines of Carmarthen named Haiwa, except that the feedstock for the Welsh single-cell protein factories was coal instead of oil shale. Her world had been almost exactly like mine. Her way out of it had not been a lottery ticket, but 2 years as crew on a commercial spaceship. She couldn't even go back home. She had jumped ship on Gateway, forfeiting her bond of money she couldn't pay. And she couldn't prospect either, because her one launch had left her with a heart arrhythmia that sometimes looked like it was getting better and sometimes put her in terminal hospital for a week at a time. Haiwa's job was partly to cook and clean for Clara and me, partly to babysit the little girl, Kathy Francis, when her father was on duty and Clara didn't want to be bothered. Clara had been losing pretty heavily at the casino, so she really couldn't afford Haiwa, but then she couldn't afford me either. What made it easy to turn off our insights was that we pretended to each other, and sometimes to ourselves, that what we were doing was preparing ourselves really well for the day when the right trip came along. It wasn't hard to do that. A lot of real prospectors did the same thing between trips. There was a group that called itself the Heechee Seekers, which met on Wednesday nights. It had been started by a prospector named Sam Kahane, kept up by others while he was off on a trip that hadn't worked out, and now had Sam back in it between trips while he was waiting for the other two members of his crew to get back in shape for the next one. Among other things, they had come back with scurvy due to a malfunction in the food freezer. Sam and his friends were gay and apparently set in a permanent three-way relationship, but that didn't affect his interest in Heechee lore. He had secured tapes of all the lectures of several courses on exostudies from East Texas Reserve, where Professor Hegrame had made himself the world's foremost authority on Heechee research. I learned a lot I hadn't known, although the central fact that there were far more questions than answers about the Heechee was pretty well known to everybody. And we got into physical fitness groups where we practiced muscle-toning exercises that you could do without moving any limb more than a few inches, and massage for fun and profit. It was probably profitable, but it was even more fun, particularly sexually. Clara and I learned to do some astonishing things with each other's bodies. We took a cooking course. You can do a lot with standard rations if you add a selection of spices and herbs. We acquired a selection of language tapes in the event we shipped out with non-English speakers and practiced taxi driver Italian and Greek on each other. We even joined an astronomy group. They had access to Gateway's telescopes, and we spent a fair amount of time looking at Earth and Venus from outside the plane of the ecliptic. Francie Herrera was in that group when he could get time off from the ship. Clara liked him, and so did I. And we formed the habit of having a drink in our rooms. Well, Clara's rooms, but I was spending a lot of time in them with him after the group. Francie was deeply, almost sensually interested in what was out there. He knew all about quasars and black holes and secret galaxies, not to mention things like double stars and novae. We often speculated what it might be like to come out of a mission into the wave front of a supernova. It could happen. The Heechee were known to have had an interest in observing astrophysical events firsthand. Some of their courses were undoubtedly programmed to bring crews to the vicinity of interesting events, and a pre-supernova was certainly an interesting event. Only now it was a long lot later, and the supernova might not be pre anymore. I wonder, said Clara, smiling to show that it was only an abstract point she was putting to us, if that might not be what happened to some of the non-return missions. It is an absolute statistical certainty, said Francie, smiling back to show that he agreed to the rules of the game. He had been practicing his English, which was pretty good to start with, and now he was almost accent-free. He also possessed German, Russian, and fair amounts of the other Romance languages to go with his Portuguese, as we had discovered when we tried some of our language tape conversation on each other and found he understood us better than we understood ourselves. Nevertheless, people go. Clara and I were silent for a moment, and then she laughed. "Some do," she said. I cut in quickly. "It sounds as if you want to go yourself, Francie." "Have you ever doubted it?" "Well, yes, actually I have. I mean, you're in the Brazilian Navy. You can't just take off, can you?" He corrected me. "I can take off at any time. I simply cannot go back to Brazil after that." "And it's worth that to you?" "It's worth anything," he told me. "Even," I pressed, "if there's the risk of not coming back or of getting messed up like the return today." That had been a five that had landed on a planet with some sort of plant life like poison ivy. It had been a bad one, we had heard. "Yes, of course," he said. Clara was getting restless. "I think," she said, "I want to go to sleep now." There was some extra message in the tone of her voice. I looked at her and said, "I'll walk you back to your room." "That's not necessary, Bob." "I'll do it anyhow," I said, ignoring the message. "Good night, Francie. See you next week." Clara was already halfway to the downshaft, and I had to hurry to catch up to her. I caught the cable and called down to her, "If you really want me to, I'll go back to my own place." She didn't look up, but she didn't say that was what she wanted either. So I got off at her level and followed her to her rooms. Kathy was sound asleep in the outer room. Hiwa, drowsing over a hollow disk in our bedroom. Clara sent the maid home and went in to make sure the child was comfortable. I sat on the edge of the bed waiting for her. "Maybe I'm premenstrual," Clara said when she came back. "I'm sorry. I just feel edgy." "I'll go if you want me to." "Jesus, Bob, quit saying that." Then she sat down next to me and leaned against me so that I would put my arm around her. "Kathy's so sweet," she said after a moment, almost wistfully. "You'd like to have one of your own, wouldn't you?" "I will have one of my own." She leaned back, pulling me with her. "I wish I knew when, that's all. I need a lot more money than I have to give a kid a decent life, and I'm not getting any younger." We lay there for a moment, and then I said into her hair, "That's what I want too, Clara." She sighed. "Do you think I don't know that?" Then she tensed and sat up. "Who's that?" "Somebody was scrabbling at the door. It wasn't locked. We never did that. But nobody ever came in without being invited either. And this time, someone did." "Sterling," Clara said, surprised. She remembered her manners. "Bob, this is Sterling Francis, Kathy's father. Bob Broadhead." "Hello," he said. He was much older than I'd thought that little girl's father would be, at least 50, and looking very much older and more weary than seemed natural. "Clara," he said, "I'm taking Kathy back home on the next ship. I think I'll take her tonight, if you don't mind. I don't want her to hear from somebody else." Clara reached out for my hand without looking at me. "Hear what?" "About her mother." Francis rubbed his eyes, then said, "Oh, didn't you know? Jan's dead. Her ship came back a few hours ago. All four of them in the lander got into some kind of fungus. They swelled up and died. I saw her body. She looks..." He stopped. "The one I'm really sorry for," he says, "is Anna Lee. She stayed in orbit while the others went down, and she brought Jan's body back. I guess she was kind of crazy. Why bother? It was too late to matter to Jan. Well, anyway, she could only bring two of them. That was all the room in the freezer, and, of course, her rations." He stopped again, and this time he didn't seem able to talk anymore. So I sat on the edge of the bed while Clara helped him wake the child and bundle her up to take her back to his own rooms. While they were out, I dialed a couple of displays on the PV and studied them very carefully. By the time Clara came back, I had turned off the PV and was sitting cross-legged on the bed, thinking hard. "Christ," she said glumly, "if this night isn't a bummer." She sat down at the far corner of the bed. "I'm not sleepy after all," she said. "Maybe I'll go up and win a few bucks at the roulette table." "Let's not," I said. I'd sat next to her for 3 hours the night before while she first won $10,000 and then lost 20. "I have a better idea. Let's ship out." She turned full around to look at me so quickly that she floated up off the bed for a moment. "What?" "Let's ship out." She closed her eyes for a moment and, without opening them, said, "When?" "Launch 29-40. It's a five and there's a good crew. Sam Cahane and his buddies. They're all recovered now, and they need two more to fill the ship. She stroked her eyelids with her fingertips, then opened them and looked at me. Well, Bob, she said, you do have interesting suggestions. There were shades over the heachy metal walls to cut down the light for sleeping, and I had drawn them, but even in the filtered dimness, I could see how she looked, frightened. Still, what she said was, they're not bad guys. How do you get along with gays? I'll leave them alone, they leave me alone, especially if I've got you. She said, and then she crawled over to me, wrapped her arms around me, pulled me down, and buried her head in my neck. Why not? She said, so softly that I was not at first sure I had heard her. When I was sure, the fear hit me. There had always been the chance she would say no. I would have been off the hook. I could feel myself shaking, but I managed to say, then we'll file for it in the morning? She shook her head. No, she said, her voice muffled. I could feel her trembling as much as I was. Get on the phone, Bob. We'll file for it now, before we change our minds. A note on the Heechee rump. Professor Hegrame, we have no idea what the Heechee looked like except for inferences. Probably they were bipeds. Their tools fit human hands tolerably well, so probably they had hands, or something like them. They seem to have seen pretty much the same spectrum as we do. They must have been smaller than us, say 150 centimeters or less. And they had funny-looking rumps. Question, what do you mean, funny-looking rumps? Professor Hegrame, well, did you ever look at the pilot's seat in a Heechee ship? It's two flat pieces of metal joined in a V-shape. You couldn't sit in it for 10 minutes without pinching your bottom off. So what we have to do, we stretch a webbing seat across them. But that's a human addition. The Heechee didn't have anything like that. So their bodies must have looked more or less like a wasp's, with this big abdomen hanging down, actually extending below the hips, between the legs. Question, do you mean they might have had stingers like wasps? Professor Hegrame, stingers? No, I don't think so, but maybe. Or maybe they had hell's own set of sex organs. End a note on the Heechee rump. The next day I quit my job, packed my belongings into the suitcases I had brought them in, and turned them over for safekeeping to Shiki, who looked wistful. Clara quit the school and fired her maid, who looked seriously worried, but didn't bother about packing. She had quite a lot of money left, Clara did. She prepaid the rent on both her rooms and left everything just the way it was. We had a farewell party, of course. We went through it without my remembering a single person who was there. And then, all of a sudden, we were squeezing into the lander, climbing down into the capsule while Sam Kahane methodically checked the settings. We locked ourselves into our cocoons. We started the automatic sequencers. And then there was a lurch and a falling, floating sensation before the thrusters cut in and we were on our way. Mission report. Vessel 1-8, Voyage 013-D6, crew F. Ito. Transit time, 41 days, 2 hours. Position not identified. Instrument recordings damaged. Transcript of crewman's tape follows. The planet seems to have a surface gravity in excess of 2.5, but I'm going to attempt a landing. Neither visual nor radar scanning penetrates the clouds of dust and vapor. It really is not looking very good, but this is my 11th launch. I'm setting the automatic return for 10 days. If I am not back by then with the lander, I think the capsule will return by itself. I wish I knew what the spots and flares on the sun meant. Crewman was not aboard when ship returned. No artifacts or samples. Landing vehicle not secured. Vessel damaged. End mission report. Chapter 13. Good morning, Bob, says Siegfried, and I stop in the door of the room suddenly and subliminally worried. What's the matter? There's nothing the matter, Rob. Come in. You've changed things around, I say accusingly. That's right, Robbie. Do you like the way the room looks? I study it. The throw pillows are gone from the floor. The non-objective paintings are off the wall. Now he's got a series of holo pictures of space scenes and mountains and seas. The funniest thing of all is Siegfried himself. He is speaking to me out of a dummy that's sitting back in a corner of the room, holding a pencil in his hands, looking up at me from behind dark glasses. You've turned out very camp, I say. What's the reason for all this? His voice sounds as though he were smiling benevolently, although there is no change in the expression on the face of the dummy. I just thought you'd enjoy change, Rob. I take a few steps into the room and stop again. You took the mat away. Don't need it, Bob. As you see, there's a new couch. That's very traditional, isn't it? He coaxes. Why don't you just lie down on it? See how it feels. But I stretch out on it cautiously. How it feels is strange, and I don't like it, probably because this particular room represents something serious to me, and changing it around makes me nervous. The mat had straps, I complain. So does the couch, Bob. You can pull them out of the sides. Just feel around. There. Isn't that better? No, it isn't. I think, he says softly, that you should let me decide whether, for therapeutic reasons, some sort of change is in order, Rob. I sit up. And that's another thing, Siegfried. Make up your fucking mind what you're going to call me. My name isn't Rob, or Robbie, or Bob. It's Robinette. I know that, Robbie. You're doing it again. A pause, then silkily, I think you should allow me the choice of the form of address I prefer, Robbie. I have an endless supply of those non-committal non-words. In fact, I would like to conduct the whole session without revealing any more than that. What I want is for Siegfried to reveal. I want to know why he calls me by different names at different times. I want to know what he finds significant in what I say. I want to know what he really thinks of me. If a clanking piece of tin and plastic can think, I mean. Of course, what I know, and Siegfried doesn't, is that my good friend S. Yaw has practically promised to let me play a little joke on him. I am looking forward to that a lot. Is there anything you'd like to tell me, Rob? No. He waits. I'm feeling somewhat hostile and non-communicative. I think part of it is because I am so much looking forward to the time when I can play a little trick on Siegfried. But the other part is because he has changed around the auditing room. That's the kind of thing they used to do to me when I had my psychotic episode in Wyoming. Sometimes I'd come in for a session, and they'd have a hologram of my mother, for Christ's sake. It looked exactly like her, but it didn't smell like her or feel like her. In fact, you couldn't feel it at all. It was only light. Sometimes they'd have me come in there in the dark, and something warm and cuddly would take me in its arms and whisper to me. I didn't like that. I was crazy, but I wasn't that crazy. Siegfried is still waiting, but I know that he won't wait forever. Pretty soon he's going to start asking me questions, probably about my dreams. Have you had any dreams since I last saw you, Bob? I yawn. The whole subject is very boring. I don't think so. Nothing important, I'm sure. I'd like to hear what they were, even a fragment. You're a pest, Siegfried. Do you know that? I'm sorry you feel I'm a pest, Rob. Well, I don't think I can remember even a fragment. Try, please. Oh, cripes. Well, I get comfortable on the couch. The only dream I can think of is absolutely trivial, and I know there's nothing in it that relates to anything traumatic or pivotal, but if I told him that, he would get angry. So I say obediently, I was in a car of a long railroad train. There were a number of cars hooked up together, but you could go from one to the other. They were full of people I knew. There was a woman, a sort of motherly type who coughed a lot, and another woman who, well, she looked rather strange. At first, I thought she was a man. She was dressed in a sort of utility coverall, so you couldn't tell from that whether she was male or female. And she had very masculine, bushy eyebrows. But I was sure she was a woman. Did you talk to either of these women, Bob? Please don't interrupt, Siegfried. You make me lose my train of thought. I'm sorry, Rob. I go on with the dream. I left them. No, I didn't talk to them. I went back into the next car. That was the last one on the train. It was coupled to the rest of the train with a sort of... Let's see, I don't know how to describe it. It was like one of those expanding gatefold things made out of metal, you know? And it stretched. I stopped for a moment, mostly out of boredom. I feel like apologizing for having such a dumb, irrelevant dream. You say the metal connector stretched, Bob? Siegfried prompts me. That's right, it stretched. So, of course, the car I was in kept dropping back, farther and farther behind the others. All I could see was the taillight, which was sort of in the shape of her face, looking at me. I lose the thread of what I am saying. I try to get back on the track. I guess I felt as though it was going to be difficult to get back to her, as if she... I'm sorry, Siegfried, I don't remember clearly what happened around there. Then I woke up, and I finish virtuously. I wrote it all down as soon as I could, just the way you tell me to. I appreciate that, Bob, Siegfried says gravely. He waits for me to go on. I shift restlessly. This couch isn't nearly as comfortable as the mat, I complain. I'm sorry about that, Bob. You said you recognized them? Who? The two women on the train that you were getting farther and farther away from. Oh, no, I see what you mean. I recognized them in the dream. Really, I have no idea who they were. Did they look like anyone you knew? Not a bit. I wondered about that myself. Siegfried says, after a moment, which I happen to know is his way of giving me a chance to change my mind about an answer he doesn't like, you mentioned one of the women was a motherly type who coughed. Yes, but I didn't recognize her. I think, in a way, she did look familiar, but, you know, the way people in a dream do. He says patiently, can you think of any woman you've ever known who was motherly and coughed a lot? I laughed out loud at that. Dear friend, Siegfried, I assure you, the women I know are not at all the motherly type, and they are all on at least major medical. They're not likely to cough. I see. Are you sure, Robbie? Don't be a pain in the ass, Siegfried, I say, angry because the crappy couch is hard to get comfortable on, and also because I need to go to the bathroom, and this situation looks to be prolonging itself indefinitely. I see. And after a moment, he picks up on something else, as I know he is going to. He's a pigeon, Siegfried is, pecking at everything I throw out before him, one piece at a time. How about the other woman, the one with the bushy eyebrows? What about her? Did you ever know any girl who had bushy eyebrows? Oh, Christ, Siegfried, I've gone to bed with 500 girls. Some of them have every kind of eyebrows you ever heard of. No particular one? Not that I can think of offhand. Not offhand, Bob. Please make an effort to remember. It is easier to do what he wants than to argue with him about it, so I make the effort. All right, let's see. Ida May? No. Sue Ann? No. Esya? No. Gretchen? No. Well, to tell you the truth, Siegfried, Gretchen was so blonde I couldn't really tell you if she had eyebrows at all. Those are girls you've known recently, aren't they, Rob? Perhaps someone longer ago. You mean way back? I reflect deeply, as far back as I can go, all the way to the food mines and Sylvia. I laugh out loud. You know something, Siegfried? It's funny, but I can hardly remember what Sylvia looked like. Oh, wait a minute. No, now I remember. She used to pluck her eyebrows almost all together away and then pencil them in. The reason I know is one time when we were in bed together, we drew pictures on each other with her eyebrow pencil. I can almost hear him sigh. The cars, he says, pecking at another bright bit. How would you describe them? Like any railroad train, long, narrow, moving pretty fast through the tunnel. Long and narrow, moving through a tunnel, Bob? I lose my patience at that. He is so fucking transparent. Come on, Siegfried. You don't get away with any corny penis symbols with me. I'm not trying to get away with anything, Bob. Well, you're being an asshole about this whole dream. I swear you are. There's nothing in it. The train was just a train. I don't know who the women were. And listen, while we're on the subject, I really hate this goddamn couch. For the kind of money my insurance is paying you, you can do a lot better than this. He has really gotten me angry now. He keeps trying to get back to the dream, but I'm determined to get a fair shake from him for the insurance company's money. And by the time I leave, he has promised to redecorate before my next visit. As I go out that day, I feel pretty pleased with myself. He is really doing me a lot of good. I suppose it is because I'm getting the courage to stand up to him, and perhaps all this nonsense has been helpful to me in that way, or in some way, even if it is true that some of his ideas are pretty crazy. Chapter 14. I struggled out of my sling to get out of the way of Clara's knee and bumped into Sam Cahane's elbow. Sorry, he said, not even looking around to see who he was sorry about. His hand was still on the go-teat, although we were 10 minutes on our way. He was studying the flickering colors on the Heechee instrument board, and the only time he looked away was when he glanced at the view screen overhead. I sat up, feeling very queasy. It had taken me weeks to get used to Gateway's virtual absence of gravity. The fluctuating G-forces in the capsule were something else. They were very light, but they didn't stay the same for more than a minute at a time, and my inner ear was complaining. I squeezed out of the way into the kitchen area, with one eye on the door to the toilet. Ham Taya was still in there. If he didn't get out pretty soon, my situation was going to become critical. Clara laughed, reached out from her sling, put an arm around me. "Poor Bobby," she said, "and we're just beginning." I swallowed a pill and recklessly lit a cigarette and concentrated on not throwing up. I don't know how much it was actually motion sickness. A lot of it was fear. There is something very frightening about knowing that there is nothing between you and instant ugly death except a thin skin of metal made by some peculiar strangers 500,000 years ago. And about knowing that you're committed to go somewhere over which you no longer have any control, which may turn out to be extremely unpleasant. I crawled back into my sling, stubbed out the cigarette, closed my eyes, and concentrated on making the time pass. There was going to be a lot of it to pass. The average trip lasts maybe 45 days each way. It doesn't matter as much as you might think how far you are going, 10 light years or 10,000. It matters some, but not linearly. They tell me that these ships are continually accelerating and accelerating the rate of acceleration the whole time. That delta isn't linear either, or even exponential in any way that anybody can figure out. You hit the speed of light very quickly, in less than an hour. Then it seems to take quite a while before you exceed it by very much. Then they really pick up speed. You can tell all this, they say, by watching the stars displayed on the overhead Heechee navigation screen, they say. Inside the first hour, the stars all begin to change color and swim around. When you pass C, you know it, because they've all clustered in the center of the screen, which is in front of the ship as it flies. Actually, the stars haven't moved. You're catching up with the light emitted by sources behind you, or to one side. The photons that are hitting the front viewer were emitted a day, or a week, or 100 years ago. After a day or two, they stop even looking like stars. There's just a sort of mottled gray surface. It looks a little like a holofilm held up to the light, but you can make a virtual image out of a holofilm with a flashlight, and nobody has ever made anything but pebbly gray out of what's on the Heechee screens. By the time I finally got into the toilet, the emergency didn't seem as emergent, and when I came out, Clara was alone in the capsule checking star images with the theodolitic camera. She turned to regard me, then nodded. "You're looking a little less green," she said approvingly. "I'll live." "Where are the boys?" "Where would they be? They're down in the lander. Dredd thinks maybe we should split things up, so you and I get the lander to ourselves part of the time while they're up here. Then we come up here, and they take it." "Hmm." That sounded pretty nice, actually. I'd been wondering how we were going to work out anything like privacy. "Okay. What do you want me to do now?" She reached over and gave me an absent-minded kiss. "Just stay out of the way. Know what? We look like we're going almost towards straight galactic north." I received that information with the weighty consideration of ignorance. Then I said, "Is that good?" She grinned. "How can you tell?" I lay back and watched her. If she was as frightened as I was, and I had little doubt she was, she certainly was not letting it show. I began wondering what was toward galactic north, and more important, how long it would take us to get there. The shortest trip to another star system on record was 18 days. That was Barnard's star, and it was a bust, nothing there. The longest, or anyway the longest anybody knows of so far, who knows how many ships containing dead prospectors are still on their way back from maybe M31 in Andromeda, was 175 days each way. They did come back dead. Hard to tell where they were. The pictures they took didn't show much, and the prospectors themselves, of course, were no longer in condition to say. When you start out, it's pretty scary, even for a veteran. You know you're accelerating. You don't know how long the acceleration will last. When you hit turnaround, you can tell. First thing you know, formally, because that golden coil in every Heechee ship flickers a little bit. No one knows why. But you know that you're turning around even without looking, because the little pseudo-grav that had been dragging you toward the back of the ship now starts dragging you toward the front. Bottom becomes top. Why didn't the Heechee just turn their ships around in mid-flight so as to use the same propulsive thrust for both acceleration and deceleration? I wouldn't know. You'd have to be a Heechee to know that. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that all their viewing equipment seems to be in front. Maybe it's because the front part of the ship is always heavily armored, even in the lightweight ships, against, I guess, the impact of stray molecules of gas or dust. But some of the bigger ships, a few threes, and almost all the fives, are armored all over. They don't turn around either. So anyway, when the coil flickers and you feel the turnaround, you know you've done one quarter of your actual travel time. Not necessarily a quarter of your total out time, of course. How long you stay at your destination is another matter entirely. You make up your own mind about that, but you've gone half of the automatically controlled trip out. So you multiply the number of days elapsed so far by 4, and if that number is less than the number of days your life support capability is good for, then you know that at least you don't have to starve to death. The difference between the two numbers is how long you can hang around at destination. Your basic ration, food, water, air replenishment, is for 250 days. You can stretch it to 300 without much trouble. You just come back skinny and maybe with a few deficiency diseases. So if you get up to 60 or 65 days on the outbound leg without turnaround, then you know you may be having a problem, and you begin eating lighter. If you get up to 80 or 90, then your problem solves itself, because you don't have any options anymore. You're going to die before you get back. You could try changing the course settings, but that's just another way of dying, as far as can be told from what the survivors say. Presumably, the Heechee could change course when they wanted to, but how they did it is one of those great unanswered questions about the Heechee, like why did they tidy everything up before they left, or what did they look like, or where did they go? There used to be a jokey kind of book they sold at the fairs when I was a kid. It was called Everything We Know About the Heechee. It had 128 pages, and they were all blank. If Sam and Dredd and Mohammed were gay, and I had no reason to doubt it, they didn't show much of it in the first few days. They followed their own interests, reading, listening to music tapes with earphones, playing chess, and, when they could talk Clara and me into it, Chinese poker. We didn't play for money. We played for shift time. After a couple of days, Clara said it was more like winning to lose, because if you lost, you had more to occupy your time. They were quite benignly tolerant of Clara and me, the oppressed heterosexual minority in the dominantly homosexual culture that occupied our ship, and gave us the lander an exact 50% of the time, even though we comprised only 40% of the population. We got along. It was good that we did. We were living in each other's shadow, and stink every minute. The inside of a Heechee ship, even a five, is not much bigger than an apartment kitchen. The lander gives you a little extra space, add on the equivalent of a fair-sized closet, but on the outleg, at least that's usually filled with supplies and equipment. And from that total available cubage, say 42 or 43 cubic meters, subtract what else goes into it besides me and thee, and the other prospectors. When you're in Tau space, you have a steady low thrust of acceleration. It isn't really acceleration. It is only a reluctance of the atoms of your body to exceed C, and it can as well be described as friction as gravity. But it feels like a little gravity. You feel as though you weighed about 2 kilos. This means you need something to rest in when you are resting. And so each person in your crew has a personal folding sling that opens out and wraps around you to sleep in, or folds to become a sort of a chair. Add to that each person's own personal space, cupboards for tapes and discs and clothing. You don't wear much of that. For toilet articles, for pictures of the near and dear, if any, for whatever you have elected to bring up to your total allowance of weight and bulk, 75 kilograms, one-third of a cubic meter, and you have a certain amount of crowding already. Add on to that the original Heechee equipment of the ship. Three-quarters of that you will never use. Most of it you wouldn't know how to use if you had to. What you do with it, most of all, is leave it alone. But you can't remove it. Heechee machinery is integrally designed. If you amputate a piece of it, It dies. Perhaps if we knew how to heal the wound, we could take out some of the junk and the ship would operate anyway. But we don't, and so it stays. The great diamond-shaped golden box that explodes if you try to open it. The flimsy spiral of golden tubing that from time to time glows, and even more often becomes unneighborly hot. No one knows why, exactly. And so on. It all stays there, and you bump against it all the time. Add on to that the human equipment. The spacesuits, one apiece, fitted to your form and figure. The photographic equipment. The toilet and bath installations. The food preparing section. The waste disposers. The test kits. The weapons. The drills. The sample boxes. The entire rig that you take down to the surface of the planet with you, if you happen to be lucky enough to reach a planet you can land on. What you have left is not very much. It is a little like living for weeks on end under the hood of a very large truck with the engine going and with four other people competing for space. After the first 2 days, I developed an unreasoning prejudice against Ham Taya. He was too big. He took more than his fair share. To be truthful, Ham wasn't even as tall as I was, though he weighed more. But I didn't mind the amount of space I took up. I only minded when other people got in the way of it. Sam Kahane was a better size, no more than 160 centimeters, with stiff black beard and coarse crinkled hair all up his abdomen, over his cache-sex to his chest, and all up and down his back as well. I didn't think of Sam as violating my living space until I found a long black beard hair in my food. Ham, at least, was almost hairless, with a soft golden skin that made him look like a Jordanian harem eunuch. Did the Jordanian kings have eunuchs in their harems? Did they have harems? Ham didn't seem to know much about that. His parents had lived in New Jersey for 3 generations. I even found myself contrasting Clara with Sherry, who was at least 2 sizes smaller. Not usually. Usually Clara was just right. And Dred Frauenglass, who came with Sam's set, was a gentle, thin young man who didn't talk much and seemed to take up less room than anyone else. I was the virgin in the group, and everybody took turns showing me how to do what little we had to do. You have to take the routine photographic and spectrometer readings, keep a tape of readouts from the Heechee control panel, where there are constant minute variations in hue and intensity from the colored lights. They still keep studying them, hoping to understand what they mean. Snap and analyze the spectra of the Tau space stars in the view screen. And all that put together takes, maybe 2 man-hours a day. The household tasks of preparing meals and cleaning up take about another 2. So you have used up some 4 man-hours out of each day for the 5 of you, in which you have collectively something like 80 man-hours to use up. I'm lying. That's not really what you do with your time. What you do with your time is wait for turnaround. 3 days, 4 days, a week. And I became conscious that there was a building tension that I didn't share. 2 weeks, and I knew what it was, because I was feeling it too. We were all waiting for it to happen. When we went to sleep, our last look was at the golden spiral to see if, miraculously, it had flickered a light. When we woke up, our first thought was whether the ceiling had become the floor. By the 3rd week, we were all definitely edgy. Ham showed it the most, plump, golden-skinned Ham with the jolly genie's face. Let's play some poker, Bob. No, thanks. Come on, Bob, we need a 4th. In Chinese poker, you deal out the whole deck, 13 cards to each player. You can't play it any other way. I don't want to. And suddenly, furious, piss on you. You're not worth a snake's fart as crew. Now you won't even play cards. And then he would sit cutting the cards moodily for 30 minutes at a time, as though it were a skill he needed to perfect for his life's sake. And come right down to it, it almost was. Because, figure it out for yourself. Suppose you're in a 5, and you pass 75 days without turnaround. Right away you know that you're in trouble. The rations won't support 5 people for more than 300 days. But they might support 4. Or 3. Or 2. Or 1. At that point, it has become clear that at least one person is not going to come back from the trip alive, and what most crews do is start cutting the cards. Loser politely cuts his throat. If loser is not polite, the other 4 give him etiquette lessons. A lot of ships that went out as fives have come back as threes. A few come back as ones. A note on stellar birth. Dr. Asminian, I suppose most of you are here more because you hope to collect a science bonus than because you're really interested in astrophysics. But you don't have to worry. The instruments do most of the work. You do your routine scan, and if you hit anything special, it'll come out in the evaluation when you're back. Question, isn't there anything special we should look out for? Dr. Asminian, oh, sure. For instance, there was a prospector who cleaned up 500,000, I think, by coming out in the Orion Nebula and realizing that one part of the gas cloud was showing a hotter temperature than the rest of it. He decided a star was being born. Gas was condensing and beginning to heat up. In another 10,000 years, there'll probably be a recognizable solar system forming there. And he did a special scan mosaic of that whole part of the sky. So he got the bonus. And now, every year, the corporation sends that ship out there to get new readings. They pay a $100,000 bonus, and 50,000 of it goes to him. I'll give you the coordinates for some likely spots, like the Trifid Nebula, if you want me to. You won't get a 500,000, but you'll get something. And a note on stellar birth. So we made the time pass, not easily and certainly not fast. Sex was the sovereign anodyne for a while, and Claire and I spent hours on end wrapped in each other's arms, drowsing off for a while and waking to wake the other to sex again. I suppose the boys did much the same. It was not long before the lander began to smell like the locker room in a boys' gym. Then we began seeking solitude, all five of us. Well, there wasn't enough solitude on the ship to split five ways, but we did what we could. By common consent, we began letting one of us have the lander to himself or herself for an hour or two at a time. While I was there, Clara was tolerated in a capsule. While Clara was there, I usually played cards with the boys. While one of them was there, the other two kept us company. I have no idea what the others did with their solo time. What I did with mine was mostly stare into space. I mean that literally. I looked out the lander ports at absolute blackness. There was nothing to see, but it was better than seeing what I had grown infinitely tired of seeing inside the ship. Then, after a while, we began developing our own routines. I played my tapes. Dredd watched his porno discs. Ham unrolled a flexible piano keyboard and played electronic music into earplugs. Even so, some of it leaked out if you listened hard, and I got terribly, terribly sick of Bach, Palestrina, and Mozart. Sam Cahane gently organized us into classes, and we spent a lot of time humoring him, discussing the nature of neutron stars, black holes, and Seyfert galaxies when we were not reviewing test procedures before landing on a new world. The good thing about that was that we managed not to hate each other for half an hour at a time. The rest of the time, well, yes, usually we hated each other. I could not stand Ham Taya's constant shuffling of the cards. Dredd developed an unreasoning hostility toward my occasional cigarette. Sam's armpits were a horror, even in the festering reek of the inside of the capsule against which the worst of Gateway's air would have seemed a rose garden. And Clara? Well, Clara had this bad habit. She liked asparagus. She had brought 4 kilos of dehydrated foods with her, just for variety and for something to do. And although she shared them with me, and sometimes with the others, she insisted on eating asparagus now and then all by herself. Asparagus makes your urine smell funny. It is not a romantic thing to know when your darling has been eating asparagus, but a change in air quality in the common toilet. And yet, she was my darling, all right. She really was. We had not just been screwing in those endless hours in the lander. We had been talking. I have never known the inside of anyone's head a fraction as well as I came to know Clara's. I had to love her. I could not help it, and I could not stop. Ever. On the 23rd day, I was playing with Ham's electronic piano when I suddenly felt seasick. The fluctuating grav force that had come hardly to notice was abruptly intensifying. I looked up and met Clara's eyes. She was timorously, almost weepily smiling. She pointed, and all up through the sinuous curves of the spiral of glass, golden sparks were chasing themselves like bright minnows in a stream. We grabbed each other and held on, laughing as space swooped around us and bottom became top. We had reached turnaround, and we had margin to spare. Chapter 15. Siegfried's office is, of course, under the bubble like anybody else's. It can't be too hot or too cold, but sometimes it feels that way. I say to him, Christ, it's hot in here. Your air conditioner is malfunctioning. I don't have an air conditioner, Robbie, he says patiently. Getting back to your mother. Screw my mother, I say. Screw yours, too. There's a pause. I know what his circuits are thinking, and I feel I will regret that impetuous remark. So I add quickly, I mean, I'm really uncomfortable, Siegfried. It's hot in here. You are hot in here, he corrects me. What? My sensors indicate that your temperature goes up almost a degree whenever we talk about certain subjects. Your mother, the woman jail Clara Moynlin, your first trip, your third trip, Dane Metchnikoff, and excretion. Well, that's great, I yell, suddenly angry. You're telling me you spy on me? You know that I monitor your external signs, Robbie, he says reprovingly. There's no harm in that. It is no more significant than a friend observing that you blush or stammer or drum your fingers. So you say. I do say that, Rob. I tell you this because I think you should know that these subjects are charged with some emotional overload for you. Would you like to talk about why that might be? No. What I'd like to talk about is you, Siegfried. What other little secrets are you holding out on me? Do you count my erections, bug my bed, tap my phone? No, Bob, I don't do any of those things. I certainly hope that's the truth, Siegfried. I have my ways of knowing when you lie. Pause. I don't think I understand what you are saying, Rob. You don't have to, I sneer. You're just a machine. It's enough that I understand. It is very important to me to have that little secret from Siegfried. In my pocket is the slip of paper that Esya Lavrovna gave me one night, full of pot, wine, and great sex. One day soon I will take it out of my pocket, and then we will see which of us is the boss. I really enjoyed this contest with Siegfried. It gets me angry. When I am angry, I forget that very large place where I hurt and go on hurting and don't know how to stop. Chapter 16. After 46 days of super-light travel, the capsule dropped back into a velocity that felt like no velocity at all. We were in orbit around something, and all the engines were still. We stank to high heaven, and we were incredibly tired of one another's company, but we clustered around the view screens, locked arm to arm, like dearest lovers in the zero gravity, staring at the sun before us. It was a larger and oranger star than Sol, either larger, or we were closer to it than 1 AU, but it wasn't the star we were orbiting. Our primary was a gas giant planet with one large moon, half again as big as Luna. Neither Clara nor the boys were whooping and cheering, so I waited as long as I could and then said, "What's the matter?" Clara said absently, "I doubt we can land on that." She did not seem disappointed. She didn't seem to care at all. Sam Kahane blew a long, soft sigh through his beard and said, "Well, first thing, we'd better get some clean spectra. Bob and I will do it. The rest of you start sweeping for Heechee signatures." "Fat chance," said one of the others, but so softly that I wasn't sure who. It could even have been Clara. I wanted to ask more, but I had a feeling that if I asked why they weren't happy, one of them would tell me, and then I wouldn't like the answer. So I squeezed after Sam into the lander, and we got in each other's way while we pulled on our top gear, checked our life support systems and comms, and sealed up. Sam waved me into the lock. I heard the flash pumps sucking the air out, and then the little bit left puffed me out into space as the locked door opened. For a moment, I was in naked terror, all alone in the middle of no place any human being had ever been, terrified that I'd forgotten to snap my tether. But I hadn't had to. The magnetic clamp had slipped itself into a locked position, and I came to the end of the cable, twitched sharply, and began more slowly to recoil back toward the ship. Before I got there, Sam was out too, spinning toward me. We managed to grab each other and began setting up to take photographs. Sam gestured at a point between the immense saucer-shaped gas giant disk and the hurtfully bright orange sun, and I visored my eyes with my gauntlets until I saw what he was indicating, M31 in Andromeda. Of course, from where we were, it wasn't in the constellation of Andromeda. There wasn't anything in sight that looked like Andromeda or for that matter, like any other constellation I have ever seen. But M31 is so big and so bright that you can even pick it out from the surface of the Earth when the smog isn't too bad, whirlpool lens-shaped fog of stars. It is the brightest of the external galaxies, and you can recognize it fairly well from almost anywhere a Heechee ship is likely to go. With a little magnification, you can be sure of the spiral shape, and you can double-check by comparing the smaller galaxies in roughly the same line of sight. While I was zeroing in with M31, Sam was doing the same with the Magellanic Clouds, or what he thought were the Magellanic Clouds. He claimed he had identified S. Doradus. We both began taking theodolitic shots. The purpose of all that, of course, is so that the academics who belong to the corporation could triangulate and locate where we've been. You might wonder why they care, but they do, so much that you don't qualify for any scientific bonus unless you do the full series of photos. You'd think they would know where we were going from the pictures we take out the windows while in super light travel. It doesn't work out that way. They can get the main direction of thrust, but after the first few light years, it gets harder and harder to track identifiable stars, and it's not clear that the line of flight is a straight line. Some say it follows some wrinkly configuration in the curvature of space. Anyway, the big heads use everything they can get, including a measure of how far the Magellanic Clouds have rotated and in which direction. Know why that is? Because you can tell from that how many light years away we are from them, and thus how deep we are into the galaxy. The clouds revolve in about 80 million years. Careful mapping can show changes of one part in 2 or 3 millions, say differences in ranging of 150 light years or so. What with Sam's group study courses, I had got pretty interested in that sort of thing. Actually taking the photos and trying to guess how Gateway would interpret them, I almost forgot to be scared. And almost, but not quite, forgot to worry that this trip, taken at so great an investment in courage, was turning out to be a bust. But it was a bust. Ham grabbed the sphere sweep tapes from Sam Kahane as soon as we were back in the ship and fed them into the scanner. The first subject was the big planet itself. In every octave of the electromagnetic spectrum, there was nothing coming out of it that suggested artifactual radiation. So he began looking for other planets. Finding them was slow, even for the automatic scanner, and probably there could have been a dozen we couldn't locate in the time we spent there, but that hardly mattered, because if we couldn't locate them, they would have been too distant to reach anyway. The way Ham did it was by taking key signatures from a spectrogram of the primary star's radiation, then programming the scanner to look for reflections of it. It picked out 5 objects. 2 of them turned out to be stars with similar spectra. The other 3 were planets, all right, but they showed no artifactual radiation either, not to mention that they were both small and distant, which left the gas giant's 1 big moon. "Check it out," Sam commanded. Mohammed grumbled. "It doesn't look very good." "I don't want your opinion. I only want you to do what you're told. Check it out." "Out loud, please," Clara added. Ham looked at her in surprise, perhaps at the word please, but he did what she asked. He punched a button and said, "Signatures for coded electromagnetic radiation." A slow sine curve leaped onto the scanner's readout plate, wiggled briefly for a moment, and then straightened to an absolutely motionless line. "Negative," said Ham. "Anomalous time-variant temperatures." That was a new one on me. "What's an anomalous time-variant temperature?" I asked. "Like if something gets warmer when the sun sets," said Clara impatiently. "Well?" But that line was flat, too. "None of them, either," said Ham. "High albedo surface metal?" "Slow sine wave, then nothing." "Hmm," said Ham. "Ha! Well, the rest of the signatures don't apply. There won't be any methane because there isn't any atmosphere, and so on. So, what do we do, boss?" Sam opened his lips to speak, but Clara was ahead of him. "I beg your pardon," she said tightly. "But who do you mean when you say boss?" "Oh, shut up," Ham said impatiently. "Sam?" Kahane gave Clara a slight forgiving smile. "If you want to say something, go ahead and say it," he invited. "Me, I think we ought to orbit the moon." "Plain waste of fuel," Clara snapped. "I think that's crazy." "Have you got a better idea?" "What do you mean, better? What's the point?" Well, said Sam, reasonably, we haven't looked all over the moon. It's rotating pretty slow. We could take the lander and look all around. There might be a whole Heechee city on the far side. Fat chance, Clara sniffed almost inaudibly, thus clearing up the question of who had said it before. The boys weren't listening. All three of them were already on their way down into the lander, leaving Clara and me in sole possession of the capsule. Clara disappeared into the toilet. I lit a cigarette, almost the last I had, and blew smoke plumes through the expanding smoke plumes before them, hanging motionless in the unmoving air. The capsule was tumbling slightly, and I could see the distant brownish disk of the planet's moon slide upward across the view screen, and a minute later, the tiny, bright hydrogen flame of the lander heading toward it. I wondered what I would do if they ran out of fuel, or crashed, or suffered some sort of malfunction. What I would have to do in that case was leave them there forever. What I wondered was whether I would have the nerve to do what I had to do. It did seem like a terrible, trivial waste of human lives. What were we doing here, traveling hundreds or thousands of light years to break our hearts? I found that I was holding my chest, as though the metaphor were real. I spat on the end of the cigarette to put it out and folded it into a disposal bag. Little crumbs of ash were floating around where I had flicked them without thinking, but I didn't feel like chasing them. I watched the big mottled crescent of the planet swing into view in the corner of the screen, admiring it as an art object. Yellowish green on the daylight side of the Terminator, and amorphous black that obscured the stars on the rest of it. You could see where the outer, thinner stretches of the atmosphere began by the few bright stars that peeped twinklingly through it, but most of it was so dense that nothing came through. Of course, there was no question of landing on it. Even if it had a solid surface, it would be buried under so much dense gas that we could never survive there. The corporation was talking about designing a special lander that could penetrate the air of a Jupiter-like planet, and maybe someday they would, but not in time to help us now. Clara was still in the toilet. I stretched my sling across the cabin, pulled myself into it, put down my head, and went to sleep. 4 days later, they were back, empty. Dredd and Ham Taya were glum, dirty, and irritable. Sam Cahane looked quite cheerful. I wasn't fooled by it. If he had found anything worth having, they would have let us know by radio, but I was curious. What's the score, Sam? Batting zero, he said. It's just rock. Couldn't get a flicker of anything worth going down for. But I have an idea. Clara came up beside me, looking curiously at Sam. I was looking at the other two. They looked as though they knew what Sam's idea was and didn't like it.
You know, he said, that star's a binary.
How can you tell? I asked. I put the scanners to work. You've seen that big blue baby out? He looked around and grinned. Well, I don't know which direction it is now, but it was near the planet when we first took the pictures. Anyway, it looked close, so I put the scanners on it, and they gave a proper motion I couldn't believe.
It has to be binary with the primary here, and not more than half a light year away.
It could be a wanderer, Sam, said Ham Taya. I told you that. Just a star that passes in the night. Cahane shrugged. Even so, it's close, Clara put in. Any planets? I don't know, he admitted. Wait a minute. There it is, I think. We all looked toward the view screen. There was no question which star Cahane was talking about. It was brighter than Sirius, as seen from Earth, minus 2 magnitude at least.
Clara said gently, that's interesting, and I hope I don't know what you're thinking, Sam. Half a light year is at best maybe 2 years travel time at top lander speed, even if we had the fuel for it. Which we don't, boys.
I know that, Sam insisted, but I've been thinking. If we could just give a little nudge on the main capsule drive. I astounded myself by shouting, stop that! I was shaking all over. I couldn't stop. Sometimes it felt like terror, and sometimes it felt like rage. I think if I had had a gun in my hand at that moment, I could have shot Sam without a thought. Clara touched me to calm me down. Sam, she said quite gently for her, I know how you feel. Cahane had come up empty on 5 straight trips. I bet it's possible to do that.
He looked astonished, suspicious, and defensive all at once. You do?
I mean, I can imagine that if we were Heechee in this ship instead of the human clods we really are, why then we'd know what we were doing. We'd come out here and look around and say, oh, hey, look, our friend's here. Or, you know, whatever it was that was here when they set a course for this place. Our friends must have moved.
they're not home anymore. And then we'd say, oh, well, what the hell? Let's see if they're next door. And we'd push this thing here and this one there, and then we'd zap right over to that big blue one. She paused and looked at him, still holding my arm. Only we're not Heechee, Sam. Christ, Claire, I know that. But there has to be a way. She nodded. There sure does, but we don't know what it is. What we know, Sam, is that no ship ever has changed its course settings and come back to tell about it. Remember that? Not one. He didn't answer her directly. He only stared at the big blue star on the view screen and said, let's vote on it. The vote, of course, was 4-1 against changing the settings on the course board, and Ham Taya never got from in between Sam and the board until we had passed light speed on the way home. The trip back to Gateway was no longer than the trip out, but it seemed like forever. Classifieds. I will massage your 7 points if you will read Gibran to me. Nudity optional, 86-004. Invest your royalties in fastest growing condominial nation in West Africa. Favorable tax laws, proven growth record. Our registered representative is here on Gateway to explain how. Free tape lecture, refreshments. The Blue Hill, Wednesday, 1500 hours. Dahomey is the luxury resort of tomorrow. Anyone from Aberdeen? Let's talk. 87-396. Your portrait in pastels, oils, other, $150. Other subjects, 86-569. Recorder lessons or play at parties, 87-429. Christmas is coming. Remember your loved ones at home with a genuine, recomposed, Heechee plastic model of Gateway or Gateway 2. Lift it and see a lovely, whirling snowfall of authentic Peggy's World glitter dust, scenic holo features, hand-etched Junior Launce bracelets, many other gift items. Phone 88-542. Do you have a sister, daughter, female, friends back on Earth? I'd like to correspond. Ultimate object? Matrimony. 86-032. End Classifieds. Chapter 17. It feels as if Siegfried's air conditioning isn't working again, but I don't mention it to him. He will only report that the temperature is exactly 22.5 degrees Celsius, as it always has been, and ask why I express mental pain as being too hot physically. Of that crap, I am very tired. In fact, I say out loud, I'm altogether tired of you, Siggy. I'm sorry, Rob, but I would appreciate it if you would tell me a little more about your dream. Oh, shit. I loosen the restraining straps because they are uncomfortable. This also disconnects some of Siegfried's monitoring devices, but for once he doesn't point that out to me. It's a pretty boring dream. We're in the ship. We come to a planet that stares at me like it had a human face. I can't see the eyes very well because of the eyebrows, but somehow or other, I know that it's crying, and it's my fault. Do you recognize that face, Bob? No idea. Just a face. Female, I think. Do you know what she is crying about? Not really, but I'm responsible for it, whatever it is. I'm sure of that. Pause, then. Would you mind putting the straps back on, Rob? My guard is suddenly up. What's the matter? I sneer bitterly. Do you think I'm going to leap off the pad and assault you? No, Robbie, of course I don't think that, but I'd be grateful if you would do it. I begin to do it, slowly and unwillingly. What, I wonder, is the gratitude of a computer program worth? He does not answer that, just outweighs me. I let him win that and say, all right, I'm back in the straitjacket. Now, what are you going to say that's going to make me need restraint? Why, he says, probably nothing like that, Robbie. I just am wondering why you feel responsible for the girl in the planet crying. I wish I knew, I say, and that's the truth as I see it. I know some reality things you do blame yourself for, Robbie, he says. One of them is your mother's death. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.